Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Arizalea and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 343 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down the love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I've been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I've spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I've been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, space, light, and shade. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. We start this week's show with an article by Sarah Langford, published on May 4th in the Financial Times of London. Can gardens really save the world? The climate zeitgeist is turning to backyards, but better ratings and rewards are needed to convince us all of their true power. At nearly 100, David Attenborough has earned the right to stay at home. But there may be another reason besides jungle fatigue that his new BBC series, Secret Garden, looks for wildlife outside our kitchen window. The climate change zeitgeist is turning to our backyards. The UK-based documentary claims some British gardens are almost as diverse as a tropical rainforest. Recent reports from the Royal Horticultural Society, RHS, and the Horticultural Trades Association, HTA, agree, suggesting that our private outdoor spaces can help stem wildlife's rapid decline in a country where one-fifth of species have disappeared since 1970. A slew of recent books urge similar. Garden designer Lottie Delamain's Gardens That Can Save the World, writer Kate Bradbury's memoir One Garden Against the World, and home gardener Joe Clark's Garden to Save the World. 87% of British households have a garden, but when homeowners have already paved over 42% of their surface area, is this promise for gardens big on ambition, light on proof? I declare an interest. I am the new owner of a small London garden smothered in astroturf, part of the country's 18 million square meters of plastic grass. I watch snails crawl gamely across its lurid surface and cheer on shoots forcing through its membrane. Because it is laid over boards and concrete, quotes to replace it with the real thing are £5,000. Is it worth it? Not just for the pleasure of my family, but the bigger cause. The 2025 RHS State of Gardening Report, co-authored by Professor Alastair Griffiths, suggests so. Using satellite imagery, it found Britain's 20.6 million private gardens host more than 40% of all UK bird and mammal species and more than half of all butterfly, amphibian, and reptile species, some of which fare better than in the open countryside. Collectively, UK gardens dwarf national nature reserves, both in acreage and carbon sequestration. Griffiths urges the government to embed gardens within health, education, housing, and climate policy. Evidence from public spaces already makes a compelling case. Studies in 2024 found that urban greenery sequesters up to 7% of a city's annual emissions, and that botanical gardens can cool city air by up to 5 degrees during heat waves. With up to 36,000 deaths linked annually to human-made air pollution, plants that absorb it make their own case. Persuading the government to Griffith's view may prove easier than the rest of us. A 2024 Aviva survey found that 27% of homeowners already have or plan to replace grass with non-permeable surfaces. Almost half of those surveyed believe artificial grass posed no flood risk. Aviva found the numbers worrying, though not foremost from a biodiversity perspective. Its chief executive of UK and Ireland General Insurance, Jason Stora, is clear artificial grass or low-maintenance driveways increase the chance of a localized flood. The company's 2025 report predicts up to 8 million homes in England will be at risk of flood by 2050, including parts of London and Manchester. Garden designer Marion Boswell believes that every garden can be adapted for climate change. She loathes clothesline fencing, which is no good to anybody, while hedges are utterly brilliant. Maintaining borders, preventing flooding, sequestering carbon, cleaning air, and enabling wildlife to move freely. The HGA agrees. It claims a 1 meter dense hedge absorbs in a week the pollution equivalent of a car traveling 500 miles. Benefits extend beyond birds and bees. Where you plant trees and climbers dramatically impacts the heat and cool of houses and their energy consumption, Boswell says, an underutilized advantage. She proposes a rating system modeled on household energy certificates. Homes with the higher EPC ratings can increase property values of up to 14%. A well-planted garden, she argues, should do the same. Though linking responsible gardening to council tax may be a bridge too far, a recent government consultation rejected reduced rates for higher EPC homes. But mounting evidence on flood prevention, air quality, and cooling may revive the argument. Boswell flags a missed opportunity in the government's 1.5 million new homes target. Legislation since February 2024 requires developments to achieve a minimum 10% biodiversity net gain over 30 years. But developments are measured just for having a garden, with no recognition of what it is or isn't doing for the environment or its owner. A council tax reduction for reduced sandbags after rainfall is unlikely to arrive in time to sweeten a 5,000-pound bill for my new lawn. But I have another motivation. There are few birds on my road, save pigeons and parakeets. Birdsong signals safety to our nervous system. Birds only sing when predators are absent, and this silent city in spring is too unnerving to ignore. The science is building to prove the power of gardens. Attenborough's arrival in our backyards may be the argument's best chance yet. Its problem is resilience on voluntary action. The RHS found that despite Britain's identity as a nation of gardeners, fewer than a quarter of garden owners claimed the title. Books by Delamain and Bradbury may not change that or persuade my neighbors to tear up their paving, but a rise in house value, lower energy bills, or a council tax reduction just might. Until then, the dream of a song thrush outside my window will have to do. An article by Sarah Langford, who is the author of Rooted, How Regenerative Farming Can Change the World, published by Penguin, was published on May 4th in the Financial Times. Can gardens really save the world? We turn to the Financial Times for another article, this one by Murray Withers, published on the 6th of May, How Gardening is Helping Those with Dementia. As the number of people with dementia crests 1 million in the UK, gardening projects to help reduce stress, improve mood, and stave off cognitive decline are blossoming. We start with meditation. Zach Grattan, project officer at wildlife charity Frog Life in Frome, Somerset, encourages us to tune in to our surroundings, feel the ground beneath our feet, and smell the air. It sets up well for Grattan's Wild Memories session, which involves a walk along the river, collecting leaves, fruits, and other plants to make into a mandala circular artwork back at a nearby allotment. His is one of a growing number of gardening projects for people with dementia and other neurodegenerative diseases. It's all about rejecting the stigmas around dementia, championing what people can achieve rather than lamenting what is being lost, says Grattan. In recent decades, thousands of these sanctuary spaces have opened in the UK as charities attempt to meet growing demand for their services. Last year, the Alzheimer's Society estimated there were nearly 1 million diagnosed and undiagnosed people with dementia in the UK. By 2040, that number is expected to rise to 1.4 million. From wading into and clearing out ponds and tending to sensory gardens to create wildflower meadows, these community gardening initiatives reflect a blossoming body of evidence that suggests a good dose of physical activity staves off cognitive decline, helping people to manage their condition. Carly Wood, a senior lecturer in sport and exercise psychology at Essex University, points to well-evidenced benefits of gardening for people with dementia in four key areas: physical, mental, behavioral, and social. Lower stress and BMI levels lead to lower bouts of depression and anxiety, reduced agitation, and renewed vigor, Wood says. The social element is crucial to breaking what Grattan calls a negative cycle of staying indoors in isolation. Bruce, a member of the Frome session, says, "I feel at ease with the people I'm talking to now. We have a laugh." Many dementia gardening projects also include people with other long-term conditions. Sessions are typically for 6 to 8 people, with carers and volunteers boosting the cohort. Some attendees come from a social prescribing route: patient referral to community activities to support their health and well-being, while others may have seen adverts in their local parks or on social media. In Frome, some regulars come from the care home over the road. The aim is to help them develop confidence and skills that last beyond a project. Aaron Veerappan, 30, was diagnosed with musculoskeletal conditions, ankylosing spondylitis, then developed a neurological disorder with similar symptoms to dementia. He joined a therapeutic gardening group run by Thrived at Battersea Park, South London. Here, he says, he found a calming space where cognitive tasks could feel less overwhelming. Helping to cultivate Thrive's sensory garden and herbal tea beds felt like huge achievements. The sessions have encouraged Veerappan to take part-time roles, including at the Disability Policy Center, a research organization and think tank, and allowed him to interact more comfortably with others. With his parents, he has planted a climbing jasmine at their shared home. Integral to many of these enterprises is the idea of co-production, setting up projects that are not top-down, fixed exercises, but which evolve under participants' direction. In Frome, everyone has a say in what we do, says Grattan. At Frog Life's sister projects in South London, project manager Rose Williams says the two-way process is key. "We consult with the groups to co-design the sessions because we want to celebrate their passions, interests, and strengths. For participants, having their own knowledge and skills valued can be a powerful source of self-worth." While Williams's session at Streatham and Clapham Commons are demedicalized to an extent, she argues that the beauty of wildlife gardening is that so many therapeutic outcomes are met in an organic way. An estimated 400 social farms in the UK provide another important source of sanctuary spaces. In 2018, Justin Mazzotta, founder of the Partners in Dementia Social Enterprise, started leasing land at Beetle Bank Farm near York to run one such project. He recalls feeling disillusioned by the day center setting of local dementia care services, which were not suited or meaningful for rural people. At Beetle Bank, some gravitate to gardening tasks or feeding the animals. The more physically able have helped erect polytunnels, assemble raised beds, and build climbing frames, shelves, and tables from reclaimed wood. Masoda also believes in co-production and constantly adapting to meet individual needs. At Beetle Bank, this extends to attendees advising what grants should be spent on, making them active agents of the service. It's all part of an enabling approach. Not everything has to pass through the staff member. With four gardens in Battersea Park and one each in Birmingham and Reading, Thrive follows more closely the principles of social and therapeutic horticulture, STH, which itself draws on occupational therapy. This is an active process, says Chief Executive Ben Thomas. Structuring it enables targeted outcomes. For the client gardeners of its Garden Time Dementia program, that structure allows for a spectrum of different activities. There's a garden task for everyone. At Streatham Commons Rookery Gardens, where I take part in planting bulbs as others clear out ponds, the camaraderie and sense of fun are palpable. Feeling valued follows on from increased interaction. Members like to feel they've made a meaningful contribution, Williams says, adding, people with dementia can report a loss of purpose and achievement. Our group doesn't advertise itself as come and take your gardening medicine, but as we need your help to get things done. Margaret, a Beetle Bank attendee, says, one minute we might be getting food ready for animals. Another minute we're planting rhubarb. You learn new skills as well as meeting new people, and that makes you feel good. Building a dementia-friendly green space with a focus on multi-sensory benefits helps the process. Planting familiarly fragrant herbs such as rosemary and lavender can trigger welcome memories, while Thrive Gardens' time sessions often finish with a brew made from ingredients grown in its herbal tea bed. Masoda highlights sensory cues such as sheep bleating. He also runs separate services, including cognitive rehabilitation sessions that help people with dementia meet goals they set themselves. Despite the supportive frameworks, participants can vacillate between enthusiasm and apathy. Sundowning, a big risk factor in dementia care, may not often affect projects that are generally held in the middle of the day, but the mood swings it can trigger may alter perceptions about the value of attending. Thomas says projects must balance a range of disability needs with running a living garden. There are also constant challenges at an organizational level, he adds. All the places cited in this report have multi-year funding from bodies such as the National Lottery Heritage Fund in place. But there is an overdependence on grants in this nonprofit sector. The referral process can eat up resources, as can training and recruitment. At Beetle Bank, leasing fees increased by 50% this year, leading Masoda to raise prices for participants. A lack of knowledge by some GPs and health bodies of social prescribing may also limit referrals. Essex University's Wood urges, get STH fully embedded in systems so it can be accessible to everyone. Therapeutic gardening's wider benefits, such as the reduced burden on the NHS or local authorities, optimization of green spaces as community assets, must be properly evaluated, practitioners say. That could lead to accessible gardens in any space where people are collected, Grattan said. They'll be co-managed by the people who use such spaces, leading to well-being, climate change, and wildlife benefits, and reducing lots of expensive problems. For now, project leaders will continue to focus on programming sessions to enhance the well-being of people with dementia. This is about slowing decline and living well with the condition, says Thomas. An article by Murray Withers, who is the Financial Times deputy night news editor, published on the 6th of May in the Financial Times, how gardening is helping those with dementia. We turn next to two articles by Robin Lane Fox, our friend from the Financial Times, where he shares perspectives on two gardens that I have recently visited in Pennsylvania. The first, published on May 1 in the Financial Times, Alexander Calder's sculptures offer much for the gardener's eye. The artist's work with movement, space, and time has inspired three recent exhibitions and a newly planted memorial. The subtle appeal of movement in a garden is back in fashion. The fixed appeal, or not, of statuary in a garden remains a perennial question. These opposites coincide in the art of a particular maestro, Alexander Calder, best known as a sculptor in wire and metal. His fame is enjoying a dream year like a wisteria in prolific flower. It is linked to two anniversaries. One is the centenary of his transfer from America to Paris in 1926, a move that transformed his art. Another is the 50th anniversary of his death in 1976. They are reasons for three exhibitions on Calder's work, two in America, one in Paris. They coincide, too, with a newly planted garden linked to a newly built gallery, which opened last autumn in the heart of an American city. One of the exhibitions, High Wire Calder Circus at 100, was a remarkable display of an early work by Calder soon after he arrived in Paris. It opened last October and ran until March 9 at New York's Whitney Museum, a major holder of his art. An even bigger exhibition, Calder Rêveur en Équilibre, Dreaming in Equilibrium, opened during April at the Fondation Louis Vuitton in Paris and will run until August 16th. A third exhibition links him to themes in a garden. Alexander Calder, The Nature of Movement, runs until May 31st at the Marie Selby Botanical Gardens in Sarasota, Florida, a standard bearer for shows that link an artist's work to plants and principles which it evokes. Everybody loves Calder, Selby's dynamic chief executive, Jennifer Romaniecki, told me as she watched her show pulling in the crowds. A perennial new memorial has been laid out in central Philadelphia, where Calder lived as a child. It is the densely planted Calder Gardens, linked to a new Calder Gallery, a combination which will be a new magnet in the city center, near statuary on fountains, which Calder's father, a sculptor, too, designed. Calder was a versatile artist, but he never worked as a landscape designer. He trained as an engineer, a different route to, say, Cézanne's or Picasso's. He remains most famous for his revolutionary introduction of movement into sculpture, devising what in 1931 a fellow artist in Paris, Marcel Duchamp, named mobiles. These pieces are sculptures made of wire or metal. At first they were made to move by electric motors, then by the currents of surrounding air. They are works to be contemplated as they evoke, Calder believed, patterns in the universe that cannot be seen with the naked eye. They have become parents of debased imitations, those twisting mobiles that mothers set above cots to catch babies' attentions. As the Selby Show emphasizes, Calder's mobiles presented an abstracted vision of nature in movement. They can be tellingly considered in tandem with movement in a garden, but they were always too fragile to be features outdoors. Ever invented, Calder also devised solid sculptures, ones which in 1932 the modernist artist Jean Arp ironically called stabiles. Calder diffused the irony by applying the word stabile to pieces which he envisaged in outdoor settings. In Paris, in 1930, Calder visited the studio of the abstract painter Piet Mondrian and remarked that the visit had changed his art, making him aspire to abstraction too. He envied the tall windows and high ceilings of Mondrian's studio. With his wife, Louisa, great-niece of the novelist Henry James, he bought a historic house in Connecticut and turned its neglected ice house into a high-ceiling studio of his own. Like Mondrian's, it had tall windows, and through them he could look out to a green garden landscape while sculpting. In the view, he sensed an underlying form defined by interrelations of space and shape. The Selby Show plays tribute to Calder's mobiles by showing simple metal shapes holding a bonsai tree on either edge, as bonsais are trained on wires like some of Calder's works. Outdoors, solid shapes among trees and flower beds play on Calder's stabiles. In colors like those Calder used, they are fixed onto the sloping trunks of sable palms, iconic trees of Florida, bought in and set to frame the view onto Sarasota's Blue Bay. They, too, make viewers think. Calder sometimes named early pieces after plants and unusual trees, but not because they depicted the plant itself. He also wrote how he liked the dogwood tree, perhaps because it has a shape to hang things on. A rose has only the blush of youth, no shape. I totally disagree. So, why has a Calder garden been devised to complement a new gallery of his works in Philadelphia? His grandson wanted Piet Udolf, the celebrated designer, to choose and lay out planting on nearly 2 acres. Behind it, the metal facade of the gallery would reflect the garden, while mobiles and stables by Calder on its ground floor would look out on a garden courtyard. The architects, he also specified, should be Herzog and de Meuron, designer of London's Tate Modern. Udolf's planting is still young, but it flows over an undulating ground plan imposed on a previously flat site. The head of horticulture, Aaron Monda, showed me how pale salvia nemorosa, crystal blue, bushes of Hidcote and Munstead lavender, pale blue aster microphyllis twilight, and pale veronica gentianoides add shades of blue. They were not hallmark shades of Udolf's early plantings in his career. Fine flowered sparks from the excellent Camassia blue candle give spring color, while lower down the slope, a charming epimedium pink champagne is beginning to edge pink astilbes at the garden's boundary. Pink rhododendron vassii is another clever choice. The public are allowed to walk up paths between the plantings without needing to pay. If the astilbes and monardas surprise me by surviving the hot summers in soil with an imported sandy base, there will indeed be drifts of naturalistic planting for them to admire. The Selby Show evokes Calder's mobiles and stables without installing originals outdoors. Philadelphia's Calder Garden plays on Calder's eye for natural movement without merely planting ornamental grasses. There are few shrubs to vary Udolf's habitual perennials, except by the lower entrance. There are, however, maroon Paul Scherer tulips mixed with narrow-petaled, faded red and yellow tulip acuminata, and, on a far slope, lemon-yellow tulip honky-tonk, an excellent one that I, too, have copied from the fine plantings at Hermannshof near Heidelberg. Calder, however, favored black and white, and their extreme opposite, bright red, a dreary palette for a garden. He also avoided secondary colors, ones that are so good in flower beds. He once remarked how futurist artists insisted that objects behind other objects should not be lost to view, but should be shown through the others by making the latter transparent. He used wire for this effect, whereas I think of good border plantings, valuing see-through plants without any futurist input. Calder also remarked that when he began to make mobiles, everyone was talking about movement in painting and sculpture. In reality, there wasn't much movement, only actions. In Paris, the current exhibitors credit him with introducing time, a fourth dimension, into art. What, though, about gardens, which are also artworks in the making? Movement, form, transparency were exploited long before 1930. So was time, through changing seasons. Thanks to Calder, I realized what he did not, that flower gardens exploited what he then brilliantly exploited in other arts. Calder, Rêver et Équilibre, Dreaming in Equilibrium, is at the Fondation Louis Vuitton in Paris until August 16th. Alexander Calder, The Nature of Movement, is at the Marie Selby Botanical Gardens in Florida until May 31st. Robin Lane Fox traveled as a guest of Marie Selby Botanical Gardens. This article, published May 1, was in the Financial Times by Robin Lane Fox. Alexander Calder's sculptures offer much for the gardener's eye. Robin Lane Fox's most recent column, published May 8th, Tulip Mania at Longwood Gardens is filled with tips to take home. Despite wild temperature swings, the Pennsylvania heartland of horticulture puts on a riotous spring display with many a trick. worth imitating. After heavily primroses and narcissi, late spring used to grace us with a multicolored finale. It was the time for tulips to triumph, the mid-season and late triumph varieties to the fore. In much of Britain, their timing has changed, bringing them forward to meet their flowery predecessors in an accelerated spring. Warm weather brings them out, and if hot weather follows, their flowers pass quickly. To see a true tulip spectacular in this sunny spring, I have headed to that heartland of horticulture, Longwood Gardens in Pennsylvania. They stage their tulip show in mid to late April. As they have had a severe winter, the spectacle, I guessed, would be worth admiring. Longwood Gardens derived from the vision and funding of Pierre Dupont since 1906, who masterminded the world's finest garden fountains, began the unsurpassing displays in big conservatories, and initiated so much else outdoors for each season. Besides the features of temporary beauty, many acres of Longwood's estate have recently been planted in a wildish style. 86 acres of meadow, burned in sections early March, set a fascinating new challenge to its curators. 505 acres of neighboring farmland are the latest addition to the property, to be managed by eco-friendly methods. Modern Longwood builds on an intensely garden past, but addresses in parallel our changing future. Last year, 1.77 million paying visitors came to Longwood to admire beauty and flowery skill. After the legendary Christmas shows in the conservatories, the Tulip Spectacular is a high point of the outdoor gardens calendar, planned to peak in the week of April 20th. However, even Longwood's gardeners cannot control the weather. As their fusillade of tulips was bursting into flowers, the night temperatures hit a frosty -3 centigrade. 2 days of hot sun then hit 32 centigrade, hurrying the tulips from flower to fade away. On April 22nd, I was warned they would not look their best. If I was seeing second best, my English eyes hardly noticed. Down a pair of facing borders up to 15 feet wide and 600 feet long, the flowers still look spectacular. Their colors modulated cleverly from white through 50 shades of pink to lilac, mauve, and dark purple. At the far end, beyond the darkest purples, a semi-circular side bed was a haze of double white narcissi with yellow centers and tall tulips whose flowers blended pale pink and yellow. I recognized the main narcissus, my favorite, Sir Winston Churchill. The tall tulip was Blushing Lady, a Darwin hybrid recommended for persistence from year to year. Among its tall stems, shorter Blushing Impression reinforced the scheme. It is one worth imitating in Britain. In the main borders, beside Dark Queen of the Night and Paul Scherrer, the supremo of the show, Roger Davis, prepared to be pestered by my questions. He has masterminded Longwood's Tulip Spectacular for 2 decades, knowing that failures in his blueprint will be hard to replace before primetime viewing. He seems so calm nonetheless. When does he plant? How closely does he place tulips together? Does he fertilize them? Does it matter if tulip bulbs shed their thin brown tunics before planting? Has he changed DuPont's original scheme? What about that trio of troubles? Snails, tulip fire, and wildfire. About 150,000 tulip bulbs go into the two borders, beginning to be planted in mid to late October. Volunteers join staff and Longwood student interns and work from 6 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., fortified by donuts and bagels and a 30-minute break for lunch. Year after year, they return for more. The tulips do not. They are treated as annual wonders and discarded after flowering, as their bulbs usually split into smaller bulbs and need several years to regain flowering size and strength. Davis endorses an important truth. The bulbs' performance in their first and only Longwood spring is already baked into them when they are bought. Fertilizing when planted would make little difference. Far more important is to plant top-sized bulbs and acquire them from established suppliers. Longwood buys direct from visiting Dutch wholesalers, whereas British gardeners buy from suppliers in the UK who import bulbs on their own account from growers with rich soil in the Netherlands. Even so, Longwood sometimes receives wrongly colored intruders in a batch of one shade. Dutch growers are not perfect. Whatever the gardens buy in is promptly inspected by quality controllers on site for signs of disease or pre-existing mushiness. Failures are discarded, but tulips whose brown tunics have fallen off are planted without foreboding. Davis marks out his ground plan for the year, outlining each group by spraying paint onto the soil. Bigger blocks once typified the scheme, but now he uses smaller blocks as they flow more smoothly and look, he says, less corporate. He is right. Within each spray-painted area, tulips are planted 6 inches apart and then intensified by others set between them, reducing the intervals to 3 inches. Each bulb is planted so 6 inches of soil lies above its upper lip, as slugs are less prone to attack them at such a depth. In winter, the soil settles anyway. Even after 120 days of such densely packed planting, tulip fire, the killer fungal disease, is absent. Davis monitors the borders constantly for distorted leaves and pulls out any offending bulbs at once. As for four-legged visitors, foxes prowl freely but kill rabbits, not the tulips' flower buds. Gray squirrels are deterred by all the visitors and by culls in an adjoining woodland. Perhaps on his U.S. tour, King Charles should have recruited Longwood to the squirrel accord he favors. It prescribes a contraceptive paste for food in hoppers, which only gray squirrels can access. Early flowering tulips go near the front so that they can be removed after flowering and replaced with well-developed annuals. What about Mother's Day, I ask, knowing that it is fixed in the U.S. on the second Sunday in May? Move it earlier, Davis answers. The tulips begin with white, such as double mondial and fringed snow crystal, in addition to DuPont's shorter scheme. All down the border, the spectrum of colors is artfully varied by blocks of white, either the late flowering narcissus, thalia, or white magic grape hyacinths. Grand Bedding in Britain planted tall tulips as dot plants above forget-me-nots and wallflowers. At Longwood, bulbous fritillaries are used as dot plants among the tulips. Crown Imperials in brick red and yellow and dark Fritillaria persica, a trick worth imitating. The fritillary bulbs are tilted to one side when planted so that water does not settle in their crowns. The white section includes another artful trick. Short stakes support circular baskets, which Davis hides with hanging white lobelia, packed in to look like flowering semi-standard trees. On the rebound, I find pink and white tulip foxtrot and feel even more merry. Beside it, I note tulip sweet 16 and feel prompted to a personal twirl with Chuck Berry's like named number ringing in my ears. They're really rockin' in Boston. If you want a first-class show, go for it like Longwood, full on. Sustainability is not all a garden needs to survive. Fun for a fortnight can be part of it too. Hence, they're really rockin' in Longwood, near Philadelphia, PA. An article by Robin Lane Fox, published on May 8th in the Financial Times of London, Tulip Mania at Longwood Gardens is filled with tips to take home. That wraps up edition 343 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send your comments at www.larrs.org or email us at one word, laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think of the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us even as we try to create order and impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardens, other gardeners, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky. Gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.